Hello, I'm Gary Peck, your host on Memories and Music, presented Sunday at 1 p.m. by Inco Metals Company. This week my guest will be Art St. Denis, and we'll be talking about early days in Massey and Spanish. In addition, Art St. Denis will share some interesting information about the formative period in Elliott Lake's history. Join St. Denis and myself Sunday at 1 o'clock when Inco Metals Company present Memories of Music on Stereo 92.7 CIGM FM.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Memories and Music for this Sunday, June the 7th. I'll be along in a few moments with our first musical selection on the program, but right now it's time for Gary Peck to introduce you to today's guest on the show.
Today on Memories and Music, our guest is Art St. Denis. Mr. Denis is a resident of the communities of Massey and Spanish, currently residing in Sudbury. Mr. St. Denis will be talking about growing up in those communities, and as well we'll be discussing the uranium boom in Elliott Lake beginning in 1953. However, before we begin our interview with Mr. St. Denis, we'll hear from Doug McLaughlin, our music host. Today on Memories of Music, our guest is Art St. Denis, and welcome to the program. Mr. Denis, St. Denis, would you begin by sharing with us giving us an idea of what you've done throughout your life? You were born, for example, in 1913, west of here in the community of Massey. And could we begin there?
Well, there's quite a history involved. As we grow in the community, it's there was much to do. Our fun we had was just by ourselves, and our skating rink was natural ice, and used the tin cans for pucks, and used to strap our skates on with hay wire on our boots in order to be able to get some skating. That was most of our fun. And but most of our entertainment was work. Then was the days of depression days, and all we knew was work. And my dad made sure that he had a lot of work for us. Mm-hmm. And so after school hours, we just went home and worked, and that's why we never got too far in school, because we didn't have time to study.
No, I think that often was the case with many people. You were a teenager when you moved out of Massey?
Yes, and depression days, and of course my older brother, he started a store in Webwood, and there wasn't enough work for myself. I had another brother come along, and so Dad, he decided we better open up another store, so he shoved me to Spanish. But I landed there with an old team of horses and in March with half a roll of bologna and a side of bacon and a case of beans and tomatoes and corn, and I opened the store up in March of 1931 or 32. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of the St. Denis and Sons meat market.
In that area?
Yeah.
Were your parents early pioneers in Massey?
Yes, they were, as a matter of fact.
When did they come to the area?
Well, Dad came there. He was just a 16-year-old, right from 50 miles of the town, 50 miles east of Ottawa. And that present home today there, when him and mother married, they came up there and they had to chop the timber down in order to build their house. And he got, after a few years later, he was working the lumber camps. He became quite a jobber himself, a lumber jobber. Mm-hmm. And, of course, during the Depression, the lumbering got quite a downfall, so he decided to open up a little meat shop.
Mm-hmm. Did he come to the Massey area because of the lumbering?
That's right, he came there for that.
Mm-hmm. After you moved from Massey, you indicated you started a store in Spanish. And how long were you there operating it for your father, I assume?
Well, for ourselves. We were all together then.
It was a family venture at that stage?
Yeah, a family venture. And I was there till, well, I only sold it here 2 years ago. I leased it out, though, from 58 till a couple years ago.
So it's remained in the family then?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not now.
No.
Nor the store in Massey. It's been sold a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. You also had other interests. Prospecting was one.
Well, it's the summertime there. The tourists used to come there by the drove, you know, mostly from Ohio. And got to know quite a few of the people there. And they would go up and fish in the back lakes rather than the big waters, the North Channel. And we got to be friendly with them, and so finally, after the last few years, they would not go fishing unless I went with them. And from one of these fishing expeditions, we discovered that they were, Prestonese Dome was coming in there doing the staking in 1953. So, lucky enough, we staked a few claims ourselves and ended up to be, the mining, the company that we staked ended up to be Spanish American. We had a limited company out of it.
You formed a company?
Oh, yes. And we sold it to Rio Alcom later years, mm-hmm. after we'd done the drilling. Mm-hmm. Actually, we had done most of the drilling there. We found the ore body before Rio Alcom did, mm-hmm. or even Denison.
But you were fortunate to have staked that area out.
Oh, yes, definitely.
A lot more exciting life, perhaps, than operating a store, I should expect, in certain ways.
Well, it's in different ways. Anyway, operating a store was a nice life, too. And
mm-hmm.
It's nice to, you know, meet the public and talk to them. And
mm-hmm.
Learn to speak the English, Indian language. And
you would do that in that area?
Oh, yes. You'd have to, otherwise you'd never get the Indian trade.
No, I suppose. Were there many other, was there much competition? In terms of general
stores? There was a couple of others, but they...
When you went to Spanish, for example, there would have been stores there.
Oh, yes, there was a couple of other older fellows, and I was just a kid there, and I was laughed at because I was just a little know-nothing, you know,
right.
Little fellow.
You also had a store in Webwood?
Yes, we started that one there 2 years before that. We started the one in Spanish. Older brother was there, and they were Sardo, and he was in the store there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've touched upon a number of topics. You're retired, I understand.
Well, I'm trying to retire, but it's
trying
pretty hard.
To retire.
Yeah.
You have a number of hobbies that keep you busy.
Yes, very much so.
That's an excellent way to retire. I think what we'll do is we'll turn the program over to Doug McLaughlin, and when we return, I'd like to focus in on the history of Massey.
Okay. We have a couple
first
of gentlemen.
Our music host. Welcome back to Memories and Music. Our guest today is Art St. Denis. And Mr. St. Denis, in 1913 you were born in the community of Massey. Perhaps some of our listening audience are not that familiar with the community. Could you tell us what it was like growing up in Massey?
Well, it was a lovely town to grow up with. We had a lot of open spaces, and we were proud to be able to boast that we had the only water system in the whole area, which was put in there by the lumber company years ago, all by hand. Of course, Massey's built in sandy ground, so therefore it wasn't hard to put the waterworks in, and water was fed by gravity. They pipe it in just above the graveyard rapids there with an intake, and in order not to freeze, they would have to have two outlets, one at the Sobel Bridge in Massey, another one near what they call the Brophy's Landing, and the water had to run...
Brophy's Landing.
Yeah, Brophy's Landing. Mm-hmm. And the water had to run there steady, otherwise in the wintertime it would freeze because the ground, you know, being sandy and a lot of traffic on it, the frost would go down pretty deep.
So that waterworks was established, I think, around 1906. Is that registered?
Yes.
And the people in the community, that was a source of pride for them.
Oh, yes, definitely. And the last few years, the government stepped in and they made them put a pump there and put the treated system
right.
plant, you know.
Right.
Before that, it was just right out of the river.
What was it like for a youngster growing up in Massey?
Well, it was kind of rough. Mm-hmm. It's kind of rough. We had to make our own fun and play our own games amongst ourselves. And in our case, well, we had to do an awful lot of work as a youngster.
Because your dad had a store.
We had a store. And that...
That had always led to work.
Yeah. And believe me, we worked.
Mm-hmm.
In the Depression time, of course, my young days was Depression time, and we couldn't afford to hire any men, and we needed some money, and there's a couple of prospectors who wanted to go back in Massey with wanted to hire a team of horses and bring their groceries up there. So I was elected. I was 12 or 13 then. And so we took off with the load and the horses. And it took me a week to go to Ritchie Falls and back with the horses. And on the way up, there's no
You're
bridge.
Talking Sobel Falls?
Sobel Lake.
Took
Sobel
you a
Lake.
Week to get there and back?
To Ritchie Falls and back with the team of horses.
That would be in the winter.
Summertime.
Summer.
Dead of the summer. And there was bridges that were out to the Sobel River, and we had to swim the horses across the river. And the roads were rough and stony that just about shake the inside out of you. But we made it.
Now, those were pioneer days.
You bet.
What would you recall? What what you were paid for that, what your dad would receive.
Dollar a day.
A dollar a day.
Yeah.
A lot of work for a dollar.
A dollar a day.
Were you transporting the prospectors in?
Yeah, I was taking them in there with the with their groceries, you know. And the man that I took in that they eventually owned, he's the one that started Ritchie Falls Camp.
Richard Falls?
Ritchie Falls.
Ritchie Falls Camp.
Camp. Tourist camp. Still operating.
Still operating.
And now you can go up there by car in half an hour.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Jim Gibson.
Jim Gibson.
Yeah. And the...
Did he strike it rich, by the way?
No, he didn't.
In terms of minerals?
No, he didn't.
But he liked the area, so he started to camp. Right.
Just fishing camp, you know, so tourist camp.
Was he from that area?
Yes, he worked in the lumber camps all his life. He's from Massey. And his partner was George McLeod, an old blacksmith man.
What was the main livelihood in Massey?
Farming and summertime and some tourist. But a lot of pulp and woodcut, you know. That's before the pulp days was the lumbering. What started was the lumbering days.
A fair amount of logging in the area.
Oh, yeah.
Do you recall the names of any of the early companies?
Well, one of them was Spanish River Lumber Company. Another was the Cutler Bay Company, and I forget any other.
Mm-hmm. But there were a number of them. And where would their mills be located?
Cutler? In the mouth, no, in Spanish, the mouth of the Spanish River. Mm-hmm. Spanish, and one of them was in Cutler.
Mm-hmm. Main mills, though, at Spanish?
Yeah, the Spanish, and the Spanish...
Smells
of Spanish, and on Aird Island, and John Island had a big mill there. There's four or five big mills there. Spanish, the mouth of the river, they used to call that the sorting jack. The different companies, lumber companies, would all send the logs out at once, and they would sort them out there. One company would go in one jack, and then the other.
They called it a sorting.
It's the sorting jack.
Sorting jack. How would they direct them? Did they all come down?
They all come down at once, and then every. There was men there on the booms, and every log was stamped.
They were stamped, and they just
And as the men would check them out, they'd shove them where they're supposed to go. And later years, it came to be pulp, so the pulp was handled down that came down that way. But they didn't have to sort it out; it was only the one company at a time.
When they stamp these logs are stamped really at their source, are they not? Before they hit
That's
the
right,
river,
in the bush,
they're coming down the river
before
stamped.
Before they're put in the water, they're stamped.
Mm-hmm. In the community of Massey, your dad also had some association with the undertaker.
Oh, yes. We had a team of horses there, and happened to be, and I was, again, appointed the teamster. My older brother always said he was too scared of horses, and my younger brother says he was too young, so I had to be the teamster. So anyway, as the, if horses were needed for a funeral, the... Undertaker owned the hearse, and we would supply the horses, and I was a teamster, so we'd be going all over the country with the hearse and going to different localities, Lee Valley, Walford, or wherever the case.
So you'd be traveling with them?
Oh, yes, I had to go with the
driving
horse.
Driving the team?
Yeah, I had to drive the horses. I took pride in my old horses. They're old, balky horses, though, but
mm-hmm.
One time my dad thought he was a pallbearer, and he thought he was going to be a big shot. We got the Graveyard Hill in Massey. It's quite a hill.
Graveyard Hill, they called it.
Yeah. And he thought that he's going to show the horses up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to take the lines. And I said, don't you touch them. I said, they're going to bark. No, no, no. He said, they'll be all right. So he grabs the line. And no sooner takes the lines in his hands that the horse stopped dead with the coffin, you know, body in just the foot of the hill and the procession coming up. So I jumped off the wagon, off the hearse, and I had a bridle with the with this horse here that had a string with a 6-inch string on it with a little nut on the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when the horse would bark, I'd just put that in its ear, mm-hmm. and she'd shake her head and then decide to move on. And
right.
That's what I done. And mm-hmm. I led the horse up the hill then, and my dad was still sitting on the hearse. After we got to the graveyard, he says, son, I'm not driving with you anymore, no. He said, so I'm walking down.
At least you didn't lose the hearse anyway on the way, or the coffin, rather, on the way up.
No.
That would have caused...
Come close.
That would have caused quite a concession. I've seen a few of the old hearses, the horse-drawn hearses, and they were fairly fancy, and some had glass on the sides.
This was all glass.
This was one of those.
All glass door, and
right.
Perched up on top here like a coach.
So if someone were to die in, we'll say, the community of Walford, would you go and pick the body up?
Yeah. No, not so much Walford, because they had their own graveyard there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I only went a few times there.
Mm-hmm.
But the graveyard was so close to the town there,
mm-hmm.
that they could almost carry the coffin from the church there.
Mm-hmm.
But we've gone off in Lee Valley and Birch Lake. And
areas like that.
Areas
the
like
undertaker
that.
Would go with you.
To oh,
those
yes.
Areas,
yeah.
And you'd pick the body up and bring it back and bury the individual in the cemetery at Mass.
Whatever, you know. The
dog, whatever, whichever one was the closest.
That's right. No, well, the church, you know,
mm-hmm.
different denominations and
mm-hmm.
whatever the...
There would only have been the one undertaker, I would assume, in Mass?
Yes, from John Sheets.
John?
Sheets.
Sheets.
Yeah, big fella.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever play broomball?
Yeah, we did a few times.
They talk about Massey as a home of broomball.
Yeah, we played it.
Did they talk about that when you were a youngster?
Well, we were more for hockey more than broomball and baseball in the summertime.
Right.
We had some good baseball clubs.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good baseball club. We had a fellow that fellow named Pine used to pitch for New York Yankees that
came out of
Cutler.
Came out of Cutler.
Yeah, Indian Reservation.
His name was
Pine.
Pine, and he played for the New York Yankees?
Yeah, he pitched for New York Yankees years ago.
When would that be?
Oh, gollies, that's...
30s, 40s?
Oh, before that, because I was it's in the early 30s, and I was in Spanish, and he was up in years then.
So. And he came off the reservation?
That's right.
And was he a pitcher?
Yeah, he pitched for the New York Yankees. He was good, too, and he'd pitch for us, but he was pretty old. He used to teach us, show us fellas what to do. And we had a college also, and of course, again, that's getting away from the Massey.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a big college in Spanish that the Jesuit.
Jesuit College.
Yeah. And most of those fellows there that were all, a lot of them were professionals.
And a number of them were into sports.
Oh, yes. Some of the guys played baseball, others with football. And we had one of the superiors there was Jim Primo, brother of Joe Primo.
Mm-hmm.
He was superior there.
Mm-hmm. You enjoyed Massey, I would assume.
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed the whole community. Massey,
and you get back there as well now?
Back and forth. Oh, yeah, we go back there often and see the kids and go back fishing and
mm-hmm.
go back hunting and still get our share of our fish. And
that's the main thing, isn't
yeah.
it? Now, when you were in your teens, you moved to Spanish.
Spanish.
I think we'll take a break now, and when we return, we'll talk about that part of your life. Our guest today on Memories of Music is Art St. Denis. And Mr. St. Denis, you moved to the community of Spanish, I believe you indicated earlier, just really at the beginning of the Depression, around the early 1930s.
That's right. And well, the Depression was at its best then.
At its worst.
Well,
at its height, wasn't it?
At its height.
Yes.
I shouldn't say its best, at its height.
Your dad had a store in
Massey,
and really it was because of the Depression that you moved.
That's
to,
right.
To,
my brother had one, Sardo had one. We'd opened one, like I said before, in
Webwood.
In Webwood.
Mm-hmm.
So we had
to have these stores to make ends meet, in a sense.
We had to make those stores in order to give us some work to do. Otherwise, we'd have been bumming around.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents wouldn't see to that.
No.
They wanted us to follow us to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to Spanish. My younger brother came with me, and we bought this old building we were in for $350 at $10 a month.
$10 a month paid off.
Paid off.
It probably wasn't a store when you bought it.
It used to be a store before that, years mm-hmm. years before that.
$350 would be a lot of money in 1930.
You better believe it was a lot of money.
A lot of money.
And so he was most of the carpenter, and of course when we opened the store up, we went there in the month of March, and I had to go with a team of horses in order to get the ice in so we'd be able to look for the coolers for the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
So. After the after we threw at the ice, and younger brother Leo, he got through fixing a store up in order good enough to sell a few canned goods. I harnessed hitched the horse up for him to go back to Massey, and one of the horses was pretty cross, and he wouldn't get into it. So finally, I had to come home 3 or 4 days later, and we had to shoot it because nobody would feed it. It was a son of God.
I can imagine. That's pretty drastic. Would you find $10 a month? It could be hard to make ends meet having to pay that off a month, I suspect.
Yes, a lot of days we didn't take in $2 or $3 cash.
You wouldn't take a week.
A week, yeah. And we just barely made it. but we didn't have we had no expenses.
No.
And there was people that came in from big cities such as Detroit, and came in there with the last few cents, and if their car broke down there, that's as far as they could go. And this particular fellow had a car, and he got started farming, and I had an old set of slaves, so I traded the slaves for the car. Mm-hmm. So I used the car for a few years. Mm-hmm. Even the Depression, after a few years, I was able to drive a car around. Mm-hmm. But
would you find that when it came to pay for goods, that people often would try and pay in kind?
They would trade. Butter
and eggs.
If a
fellow was a carpenter, he might do some work for you.
Or
if they had a farm, they might give you some butter for something else.
Mostly with the butter and eggs, the farmer and meat. But not so much the work, because we couldn't afford to.
No,
any work to be
probably
done.
Probably not.
We had to do it ourselves. The only time we'd hire for any laboring to do was we had to repair the building. Or when we cut the ice, then we'd get the local fellas to cut the ice by the piecework and haul them in the ice house.
When we're talking about a general store back in the 30s, you can visualize it. I imagine there were scales and there were shelves upon shelves of any good imaginable.
Great big wood stove in the center of the place, and gas lanterns, and it was something.
When a person came in to buy cookies, for example, they didn't pick a package of cookies off the shelf, but I imagine they came in boxes, did they not?
A nice little square box, about 12 inches square, and the biscuit company used to supply glass covers for them, just to open the box up, and they would just sit over the box.
The glass cover would sit over the
box, and then you just open the glass cover, and there's your cookies. And they had racks of about four, and two rows, about eight glass covers. That was our cookies. And
mm-hmm. What would be some of the other items you'd sell in there? Meat would be a major item?
Meat would be our big item, and of course, canned goods. And as the times come along, you know, a lot of the new product would come on the market. I remember when that maple spread was first come out. Mm-hmm. It was sold, I think, for about 20 cents for a great big can. In fact, they had to give it away to get the people to use it.
To begin with.
Yeah. But after you got the taste of it, and that was a big seller.
Mm-hmm. How would stores compete with other stores? Would it be by word of mouth? Would they try? Would they resort to something like sales at that time?
No, we never.
Back in the 40s?
We never believed in sales.
Not at all?
No.
In other words, if you had a good
business,
people would come back.
We had a store there. And you needed something, you know, you can get it. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't like me, well, you didn't come in, or you
got
somebody else to.
You didn't resort to stamps or anything like
that
in those days.
No way.
No, word of mouth.
When the stamps come on, I quit.
Yeah.
But it was fun, though. And the summertime, especially there in the summertime when the blueberry picking time. Mm-hmm. That was great, great country for blueberry picking. Mm-hmm. We used to ship out of there, express trains just come in, then, you know, twice a day. And we used to ship a whole express car full of blueberries every day for two or three weeks there. And finally, when the trucks come along, well, then we used to load the big tractor trailers.
Right. Give us an idea of some of the prices back in the 30s.
Well, we used to, bologna was 10, 12 cents a pound, and bread was 8, 10 cents a loaf. Mm-hmm. Of course, we used to set our own price on that because we had our own baker shop.
You had your own shop?
Yeah. And our own slaughterhouse, our own meat. We used to raise a lot of our own meats, and Massey was the center for that.
People come in and pay cash in many cases, or would you have books and
they would run up
a bill for could be a month. Or
yeah, cash was a very very
scarce commodity.
Scarce commodities, right? It was. By the month, and that was hard to take.
I've seen some of the old books from the older general stores, and they would have a page per person, would they not, or per
That's
company?
Right. A book per, you know, those little counter check books.
Right.
A book per customer. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of welfare them days in those towns. Mm-hmm. That was a way of life for a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. Still is, even if there is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. They don't know any difference. Mm-hmm. But maybe someday they'll get out of that.
Yeah. So you would really be issuing food on credit for a while, in some cases.
Well, until
money came in.
Until the money came in, or you couldn't afford it yourself, so you had to cut them off, and you know, it's business. You know, it's up and down in demand. And
I'm sure.
If you couldn't afford to give them more credit, well, you just cut them off, and they went to another store, they got hungry, and they found the money someplace and and got to pay in.
One of the advantages of a general store, I suspect, is you'd get to meet so many people.
Oh, you meet lots of them, but all kinds. You'd be the father confessor lots of times. Mm-hmm. We had no doctors.
No.
And I was one of the young lad had a car there, and when somebody needed a doctor, I was the taxi. I'd get my gas out of it. That's about all.
What kind of car was this, by the way, the one that you ended up with?
Well, it was an old Star. First, I traded with the Slays, and then ended up getting a...
What year would that have been?
That's, I think, a 28 Star.
Star.
Yeah. And then I end up getting a 32 Chevy, a one-seater Chevy Coupe.
Really moved up.
Oh, God, yes, that was something. So we done a lot of trips to Blind River, the doctors there. And
mm-hmm. Was there a doctor in Spanish?
No.
No?
We never had a doctor. Well, we had one for a few months there.
Mm-hmm. What was Spanish like as a community?
It is a bustling little town. The main...
Busier sometimes than others?
I'd say it was busy all the time, but mm-hmm. a different atmosphere. There's no farming there.
Right.
The farm would come in from Walford, and all we had there in the summer months was a lot of tourists and a lot of pulp cutting. And we had the two colleges, like the girls' school and the boys' Indian school, and they employed quite a few people. And apart from that, and higher the highway, the railroad and the highway, there was no employment whatsoever. Summer month, you had to go and pick up blueberries, or if you there's a lot of tourists, then if you were any good at it, you could become a guide. And then, there's a few commercial fishermen in Spanish there. Mm-hmm. And you may be lucky enough, you may get a job at one of them. But if you were a good guide, you had no problem getting work.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a few good ones. We had a few good fellows there. An awful lot of tourists would come in there in the summer months.
Would you find the population would be transient, or would family stay there for generations?
The family would stay there.
Children and grandparents?
Yeah. But Spanish, a few years ago when I was there, it was only about 700 or 800 population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the summer months, it would come up to, 4,000 or 5,000 with the tourists. And they'd just flood the place. And that's about the only time that we would see any hard cash.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love to see them come.
I can imagine. What about law enforcement in communities like that?
We didn't have any. Once in a while, they had to come in from Blind River.
Provincial?
Yeah, provincial. There was none in Massey. Espanola was the next one. And after the years, when the mines open up, well, of course, it got a little heavier populated, so they had to bring in the provincial police. And
right. When you look back over the years in Massey and then Spanish, where you spent many, many years, any interesting anecdotes that come to mind that we could share with our listening audience? I'm sure there probably are many, but some that we could share with them.
Well, what do you mean by...
every community, there are pranksters in the communities. There are maybe incidents in the history of the community that you recall.
Well, we had a couple of guys that wanted for murder in Detroit, and they decided to upset of course, they're dead now, so
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter.
No.
They decided one day that they'd ransack one of the stores there. Lucky enough, it wasn't mine.
Mm-hmm.
And they just... made a shamble of it.
Mm-hmm. This would be back in the 30s or 40s?
Oh, yeah, the early 30s.
In the early 30s.
In the 20s, late 20s.
Caused quite a stir in the community, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you lived in Spanish for many years and raised your family there and still have property in the area. You enjoy the community, I imagine? And
oh,
you're
yeah.
back whenever you can?
Oh, yes, every chance we can. Not this time of the year, the flies are too bad.
How has it changed since the 1930s?
Oh, there's an awful lot of difference. Everybody's rushing there now, and everybody wants to make money.
Not the quiet community that it once was?
No, it's not. You don't go around the corner and be able to talk to a fellow and say, well, here, what's the problem, what can I do? And
mm-hmm.
Not anymore, and say hi and keep on going.
They're getting caught up in the hustle-bustle of the,
they sure are,
the big community.
Like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. In a way, maybe that's a disadvantage, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of famous people went through that little old town.
Mm-hmm.
One of the hotel owners years ago wouldn't rent a room to Betty Grable.
Wouldn't?
It would not, because she had a darkie as a chauffeur.
Oh. And
that's
when was she going through?
She was going through there about 33 or 34 or something
mm-hmm.
like that. She had
it was on the CPR line then?
No, then the cars.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the cars, a chauffeur, two mm-hmm. she had two cars.
Yeah.
going through there. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And another fellow had Dark Cook and was Tom Hicks, one of the famous cowboys. He had a great big yacht. A lot of yachts used to come in there.
Mix?
Hicks. Tom Hicks. One of the cowboys, I know. I think that's his name. And he had a darkie for a cook in there. He went into the hotel and they also weren't allowed to.
No.
He had a big yacht out there. They used to come out here in Spanish and get a lot of groceries from us fellows.
Mm-hmm. Popular area, recreational area.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've had some association with the early days of Elliott Lake, the discovery of uranium, and I think we'll take a break at this time. When we come back, we'll talk about that aspect of your history. On Memories and Music today, our guest has been Art St. Denis. And, Mr. St. Denis, you were involved or associated with what we know as Elliott Lake today when that area was a little more than rock and trees. I think you were involved at the ground level. Could you tell us about that aspect, please?
Yes, right from the very beginning when we used to have to fly in there to get to Cork Lake. Cork Lake, where today is the paved highway there, going in there. We had a camp there. A fellow by the name of Westerfield had a summer camp there. He used to fly the stuff in and bring the stuff in by canoe and boats here through Massey over, through the Massey-Tote Road over the Whiskey Lake and all those portage there. And after the camp was just about finished, and we discovered uranium, and they put a good highway right by the door.
It's convenient.
But that's what we were doing that spring there when the uranium was discovered.
What period of time are we talking about when you were in there? 54?
53. Spring of 53.
All right. You were in there with a party fishing?
Fishing with Westerfield and a fellow named J.R. Gardner and a guide, Roy Smith. And these people that come in there and they start staking around us, and we figured there was an invasion going on there.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the Presney's Dome they had a strike on, so they're employees or workers would come down there and done some staking. They had the lawyer there, lawyers right there and everything to transfer the claims over right away. And,
mm-hmm.
But we were lucky enough that we wanted some claims, so we came to town and got our license.
By town, you mean?
Sudbury.
Came to Sudbury?
The only place you can go, you got to come and get your license. And we went back up there, there's still some left, so we staked a few claims and come to be known as a mining company of Spanish American.
Spanish American.
Limited. Named after myself, Spanish, and this other fellow being American.
Mm-hmm.
That is Wishart's doing. That's what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted that way. And so we done the staking there and hired a few Indians to do the bulwark. And
mm-hmm.
What we did is put our names on the posts. And we started drilling that fall. We got the two holes drilled.
Now, you were involved with the drilling.
Oh, definitely. I was.
What's entailed when one's drilling?
Well, you've got to get a company to put a bid in for so much a foot for drilling. And we started one hole, and we got it for about $5-6 a foot. And after down 2,000 feet, they stuck the drill, and they didn't know what to do, and so we decided then that we had enough claims that if we moved over for another hole, we had enough work done on that to pay for the assessment.
I see. The government would require you to begin drilling immediately since you had the claims.
Well, we were good for a certain amount of work
for 1 year.
That was
one of the stipulations.
That's right. For 1 year, then you have to do so much work.
Mm-hmm.
We had, at that time, 18 claims. So we had enough work on that hole for 9 claims, so we had to move over on another one.
And do another.
To drill another hole, and we started drill on another hole. And we were within 300 feet of the ore body mm-hmm. when we hit it. And when we started the second hole, that's when Dennison started to drill.
Mm-hmm. Dennison.
Dennison Mines.
We're talking about 1950...
3 and 4.
The fall of 53 and the...
Spring of 54.
Spring of 54. When you were up there fishing, were you aware that there was uranium in that area?
We did. We knew that a year before that.
Back in 52.
Yes. And because the Mrs. Westerfield, she used to like to walk on the Cork Dunlop River and walk on the shores. And she would locate some of these fine stones and look good. And she brought them into
the university and get it analyzed. And they told her then it was uranium.
University in
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. And they were analyzed as containing uranium.
Uranium. And Paul Westerfield, he called me up and he says we're going to stake some claims in the springtime. But by the time we got around to it, we didn't. Somebody else beat us to it, which is just as well because it wasn't the best of the ore body there.
What they were staking.
But where we were going to stake. Because a lot of the Rio Algon property is not the best of the ore body.
But you actually staked in some of the better property.
But just south of us there, right. and which happened to be lucky enough that we happened to pick that spot. Mm-hmm. The only reason why we picked that spot is because there was a road, there's a trail we used to go in and fish speckled trout there, speckles, and we use that for a baseline, so we use that for a boundary line, and that was it. Where it didn't matter where we went, we didn't know one from one place or another.
So how did you get into this deposit? There would just be a trail going in there to begin with.
Yeah, and we staked it, and then we got hired a geologist to tell us where to drill the holes, and we hit it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know nothing.
Mm-hmm. Then the community of Elliott Lake began.
Yeah, it began, they started making a road in then in 54.
The Ontario government putting it in?
No, the mining company.
Mining companies putting it in
mining
without
company.
Any assistance.
That's right. And of course, after it was in, the Ontario government stepped in.
Mm-hmm.
And they started putting the roads in there. And the first of all, it was just an old, they used to follow, the first time they followed the old lumber road. They used to have a lumber road in there. That used to be quite a lumbering area.
Mm-hmm.
And Gratis Lumber Company had all the rights, timber rights from the hardwood around Eddy Lake. Of course, they weren't using it, but they were thinking of putting the road in. And so they start putting the road in, and after a few years, and the first while, they used to go over a swamp. They used to take those logs and trees and just dump them in the swamp and haul some gravel over it, and that was what we had for road.
Mm-hmm. So Elliott Lake really was, when you were in that area, was nothing more than rock and trees. And then the community began.
The community began.
You were there when it began.
Oh, yes.
You were right there.
We had a transport there, and we used to bring all the any new business going in there. The first business was up there, all in tents. If I can find a picture of the first laundry there, it was right beside Little Lake, and Elliott Lake's first laundry, and Blay had one of the first grocery store in there, and oh, everything was tent, and mm-hmm. after roads got in, we hauled the first bank in there from a trailer.
The Royal Bank.
Yes. Yeah.
Brought it in by trailer.
By trailer. It was rough. Boy, you had about one time we had to use a bulldozer to get us through one of the mud holes. And
two companies largely had control of the area? Two?
Rio Algoma and Denison.
Denison were the two major outfits in the area?
Rio Algoma, the largest one. They had several different companies, but they're all under Rio Algon. Right.
People coming in would be working for them. You wouldn't really have individual prospectors coming in. Too many.
Oh, yes, there were still lots of them. Oh, yeah, there were still lots of them, but they never got there. In order to get ahead, like ourselves, we didn't have enough land.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't large enough to get our own company.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had our own company, a lot large enough to put our own mill up.
Mm-hmm.
So we sold to Rio Algon.
Mm-hmm.
They put a mill up, but they had to put in some other property with it.
Mm-hmm.
The 36 claims was the amount that the minimum was worth, worth putting the mill on.
Mm-hmm.
Less than that wasn't worth it.
The community started in, what, 54, 55?
54, 55, 50. I gotta forget.
And how many people would be there that first season? It would be a very small community.
Oh, it started off with maybe 500, 600 or 1,000, something like that.
And then it would mushroom.
Yeah. They put the, first of all, where today some of the big homes are there, that was the Colin McCracken, I think it's Colin McCracken. I know they had their big dining halls and everything there.
Mm-hmm.
They put one service station went up, and another one up, and then they put in streets in, and then they just kept going out right after that.
Mm-hmm. Prominent people came to the area as well. I'm sure there was a lot of interest in the uranium in Elliott Lake.
Well, we had people from all over the world there come in, and the uranium was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course it's very unfortunate that after a few years that the uranium went down in value, but that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Mm-hmm. Right, very fluctuating market.
definitely.
But now Elliott Lake seems to be on the rise again, doesn't it?
Oh, it's gone there now, and it's... although I don't think there's any more of a population now than there was at the boom time. Oh, it's in a different... There isn't as many transient people there.
Right.
They're more stabilized.
Mm-hmm. People Lester there Pearson was your member of Parliament.
He was.
You got to know him a bit.
Yes, we got to know him real well.
What kind of an individual was
very,
he?
Very, very lovely gentleman. Mm-hmm. Quite spoken and didn't speak out of turn. And, mm-hmm. and I gave him quite a ride on that old Jeep of mine.
I can imagine. Liked a good joke?
Yes, he did, but he wasn't much on jokes himself.
No, but he would enjoy a good laugh.
He liked to hear, listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave him quite a ride with that whole thing. And, I took him up there one time and had two cases of beer in the back of the... And he didn't know it. I got $100 for bringing that and two cases of beer in there.
And he wasn't aware of it?
No.
Would he go up mainly during election time?
Well, once or twice he came in between, you know, just to go through his writing.
Mm-hmm.
And another time they had appointed a liberal committee, you know, the president or whatever you want to call him. And then while he was there, he decided, well, of course, I had the only Jeep there. And
mm-hmm.
That's about the only way you can get in unless you want to fly in. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, weather-wise, it wasn't always at its best to fly in there.
Have you been back to Elliott Lake in recent years?
Oh, yes. Back. I always go back every year.
Our guest today on Memories of Music has been Art St. Denis. Next week, we'll have another special program for you on Memories of Music, brought to you every Sunday at this time by Inco Metals Company. I'm Doug McLaughlin. Have yourself a very, very good week. We'll be right back.